Chapter 7, 1755. Braddock. I have the pleasure to acquaint you that General Braddock came to my house last Sunday night, writes Dinwiddie, at the end of February, to Governor Dobbs of North Carolina. Braddock had landed at Hampton from the ship Centurion, along with young Commodore Cattell, who commanded the American squadron. I am mighty glad, again writes Dinwiddie, that the general is arrived, which I hope will give me some ease, for these 12 months past I have been a perfect slave. He conceived golden opinions of his guest. He is, I think, a very fine officer, and a sensible, considerate gentleman. He and I live in great harmony. Quote, had he known him better, he might have praised him less. William Shirley, son of the governor of Massachusetts, was Braddock's secretary, and after an acquaintance of some months wrote to his friend Governor Morris, we have a general most judiciously chosen for being disqualified for the service he is employed in almost every respect. He may be brave for aught I know, and he is honest in pecuniary matters. The astute Franklin, who also had good opportunity of knowing him, says, this general was, I think, a brave man, and might probably have made a good figure in some European war. But he had too much self-confidence, too high an opinion of the validity of regular troops, to mean a one of both Americans and Indians. Horace Walpole, in his function of gathering and immortalizing the gossip of his time, has left a sharply drawn sketch of Braddock in two letters to Sir Horace Mann, written in the summer of this year. I love to give you an idea on our characters, as they rise upon the stage of history. Braddock is a very Iroquois in disposition. He had a sister who, having gained away all her little fortune at Bath, hanged herself with a truly English deliberation, leaving only a note upon the table with those lines, to die is landing on some silent shore, etc. When Braddock was told of it, he only said, poor Fanny. I always thought she would play till she would be forced to tuck herself up. Under the name of Miss Sylvia S. Goldsmith, in his Life of Nash, tells the story of this unhappy woman. She was a rash but warm-hearted creature, reduced to penury and dependence, not so much by a passion for cards, as by her lavish generosity to a lover ruined by his own follies, and with whom her relations are said to have been entirely innocent. Walpole continues, but a more ridiculous story of Braddock, and which is recorded in heroics by Fielding in his Covent Garden tragedy, was an amorous discussion he had formerly with Mrs. Upton, who kept him. He had gone the greatest lengths with her pin money, and was still craving. One day, that he was very pressing, she pulled out her purse and showed him that she had but 12 or 14 shillings left. He twitched it from her, let me see that. Tied up at the other end he found 5 guineas. He took them, tossed the empty purse in her face, saying, did you mean to cheat me, and never went near her more. Now you are acquainted with General Braddock. Quote, he once had a duel with Colonel Gumley, Lady Bath's brother, who had been his great friend. As they were going to engage, Gumley, who had good humor and wit, Braddock had the latter, said, Braddock, you are a poor dog. Here, take my purse. If you kill me, you will be forced to run away, and then you will not have a shilling to support you. Braddock refused the purse, insisted in the duel, was disarmed, and would not even ask his life. However, with all his brutality, he has lately been governor of Gibraltar, where he made himself adored, and where scarce any governor was endured before. Quote, another story is told of him by an accomplished actress of the time, George M. Bellamy, whom Braddock had known from girlhood, and with whom his present relations seemed to have been those of an elderly adviser and friend. As we were walking in the park one day, we heard a poor fellow was to be chastised, when I requested the general to beg off the offender. Upon his application to the general officer, whose name was Dury, he asked Braddock how long since he had divested himself of the brutality and insolence of his manners, to which the other replied, "You never knew me insolent to my inferiors. It is only to such rude men as yourself that I behave with the spirit which I think they deserve." Quote, Braddock made a visit to the actress on the evening before he left London for America. Before we parted, she says, "The general told me that he should never see me more, for he was going with a handful of men to conquer whole nations, and to do this they must cut their way through unknown woods." He produced a map of the country, saying at the same time, "Dear Pop, we are sent like sacrifices to the altar, a strange presentiment for a man of his sturdy temper." Whatever were his failings, he feared nothing, and his fidelity and honor in the discharge of public trusts were never questioned. Desperate in his fortune, brutal in his behavior, obstinate in his sentiments, again writes Walpole, he was still intrepid and capable. He was a veteran in years and in service, having entered the Coldstream Guards his ensign in 1710. The transports bringing the two regiments from Ireland all arrived safely at Hampton, and were ordered to proceed up the Potomac to Alexandria, where a camp was to be formed. Thither, towards the end of March, went Braddock himself, along with Capel and Dinwiddie, in the governor's coach, while his aide-de-camp, Orme, his secretary, Shirley, and the servants of the party followed in horseback. Braddock had sent for the elder Shirley and other provincial governors to meet him in council, and in the 14th of April they assembled in a tent of the newly formed encampment. Here was Dinwiddie, who thought his troubles at an end, and saw in the red-coated soldiery the near fruition of his hopes. Here, too, was his friend and ally, Dobbs of North Carolina, with Morris of Pennsylvania, fresh from assembly quarrels, Sharp of Maryland, who, having once been a soldier, had been made a sort of provisional commander-in-chief before the arrival of Braddock, and the ambitious Delancey of New York, who had lately led the opposition against the governor of that province, and now filled the office himself. A position that needed all his manifold adroitness. But, next to Braddock, the most noteworthy man present was Shirley, governor of Massachusetts. There was a fountain of youth in this old lawyer. A few years before, when he was boundary commissioner in Paris, he had had the indiscretion to marry a young Catholic French girl, the daughter of his landlord, and now, when more than 60 years old, he thirsted for military honors, and delighted in contriving operations of war. He was one of a very few in the colonies who at this time entertained the idea of expelling the French from the continent. He held that Carthage must be destroyed, and, in spite of his Parisian marriage, was the foremost advocate of the root and branch policy. He and Lawrence, governor of Nova Scotia, had concerted an attack in the French fort of Beauséjour, and, jointly with others in New England, he had planned the capture of Crown Point, the key of Lake Champlain. By these two strokes and by fortifying the portage between the Kennebec and the Chaudière, he thought that the northern colonies would be saved from invasion, and placed in a position to become themselves invaders. Then, by driving the enemy from Niagara, securing that important pass, and thus cutting off the communication between Canada and her interior dependencies, all the French posts in the West would die of inanition. In order to commend these schemes to the home government, He had painted in gloomy colors the dangers that beset the British colonies. "Our Indians," he said, "will all desert us, if we submit to French encroachment. Some of the provinces are full of Negro slaves, ready to rise against their masters, and of Roman Catholics, Jacobites, indented servants, and other dangerous persons, who would aid the French in raising a servile insurrection. Pennsylvania is in the hands of Quakers, who will not fight, and of Germans, who are likely enough to join the enemy. The Dutch of Albany would do anything to save their trade. A strong force of French regulars might occupy that place without resistance, then descend the Hudson, and, with the help of a naval force, capture New York and cut the British colonies asunder." The plans against Crown Point and Beauséjour had already found the approval of the home government and the energetic support of all the New England colonies. Preparation for them was in full activity, and it was with great difficulty that Shirley had disengaged himself from these cares to attend the council at Alexandria. He and Dinwiddie stood in the front of opposition to French designs. As they both defended the royal prerogative and were strong advocates of taxation by Parliament, they have found scant justice from American writers. Yet the British colonies owed them a debt of gratitude, and the American states owe it still. Braddock laid his instructions before the council, and Shirley found them entirely to his mind, while the general, in his part, fully approved the schemes of the governor. The plan of the campaign was settled. The French were to be attacked at 4 points at once. The 2 British regiments lately arrived were to advance on Fort Duquesne, 2 new regiments, known as Shirley's and Pepperell's, just raised in the provinces, and taken into the King's Bay, were to reduce Niagara, a body of provincials from New England, New York, and New Jersey was to seize Crown Point, and another body of New England men to capture Beauséjour and bring Acadia to complete subjection. Braddock himself was to lead the expedition against Fort Duquesne. He asked Shirley, who, though a soldier only in theory, had held the rank of colonel since the last war, to charge himself with that against Niagara, and Shirley eagerly assented. The movement in Crown Point was entrusted to Colonel William Johnson, by reason of his influence over the Indians and his reputation for energy, capacity, and faithfulness. Lastly, the Acadian enterprise was assigned to Lieutenant Colonel Monckton, a regular officer of merit. To strike this fourfold blow in time of peace was a scheme worthy of Newcastle and of Cumberland. The pretext was that the positions to be attacked were all on British soil, that in occupying them the French had been guilty of invasion, and that to expel the invaders would be an act of self-defense. Yet in regard to 2 of these positions, the French, if they had no other right, might at least claim 1 of prescription. Crown Point had been 24 years in their undisturbed possession, while it was 3/4 of a century since they first occupied Niagara, and, though New York claimed the ground, no serious attempt had been made to dislodge them. Other matters now engaged the council. Braddock, in accordance with his instructions, asked the governors to urge upon their several assemblies the establishment of a general fund for the service of the campaign. But the governors were all of opinion that the assemblies would refuse, each being resolved to keep the control of its money in its own hands, and all present, with 1 voice, advised that the colonies should be compelled by act of Parliament to contribute in due proportion to the support of the war. Braddock next asked if, in the judgment of the council, it would not be well to send Colonel Johnson with full powers to treat with the 5 nations, who had been driven to the verge of an outbreak by the misconduct of the Dutch Indian commissioners at Albany. The measure was cordially approved, as was also another suggestion of the general, that vessels should be built at Oswego to command Lake Ontario. The council then dissolved. Shirley hastened back to New England, burdened with the preparation for three expeditions and the command of one of them. Johnson, who had been in the camp, though not in the council, went back to Albany, provided with a commission, as sole superintendent of Indian affairs, and charged, besides, with the enterprise against Crown Point, while an express was dispatched to Moncton at Halifax, with orders to set at once to his work of capturing Beauséjour. In regard to Braddock's part of the campaign, there had been a serious error. If, instead of landing in Virginia and moving on Fort Duquesne by the long and circuitous route of Wills Creek, the two regiments had disembarked at Philadelphia and marched westward, the way would have been shortened, and would have lain through one of the richest and most populous districts in the continent, filled with supplies of every kind. In Virginia, on the other hand, and in the adjoining province of Maryland, wagons, horses, and forage were scarce. The enemies of the administration ascribed this blunder to the influence of the Quaker merchant, John Hanbury, whom the Duke of Newcastle had consulted as a person familiar with American affairs. Hanbury, who was a prominent stockholder in the Ohio Company, and who traded largely in Virginia, saw it for his interest that the troops should pass that way, and is said to have brought the Duke to this opinion. A writer of the time thinks that, if they had landed in Pennsylvania, 40,000 pounds would have been saved in money, and 6 weeks in time. Not only were supplies scarce, but the people showed such unwillingness to furnish them, and such apathy in aiding the expedition, that even Washington was provoked to declare that they ought to be chastised. Many of them thought that the alarm about French encroachment was a device of designing politicians, and they did not awake to a full consciousness of the peril till it was forced upon them by a deluge of calamities, produced by the purblind folly of their own representatives, who, instead of frankly promoting the expedition, displayed a perverse and exasperating narrowness which chafed Braddock to fury. He praises the New England colonies, and echoes Dinwiddie's declaration that they have shown a fine martial spirit, and he commends Virginia, as having done far better than her neighbors, but for Pennsylvania he finds no words to express his wrath. He knew nothing of the intestine war between proprietaries and people, and hence could see no palliation for a conduct which threatened to ruin both the expedition and the colony. Everything depended on speed, and speed was impossible, for stores and provisions were not ready, though notice to furnish them had been given months before. The quartermaster general, Sir John Sinclair, stormed like a lion rampant, but with small effect. Contracts broken or disavowed, want of horses, want of wagons, want of forage, want of wholesome food, or sufficient food of any kind, caused such delay that the report of it reached England, and drew from Walpole the comment that Braddock was in no hurry to be scalped. In reality he was maddened with impatience and vexation. A powerful ally presently came to his aid in the shape of Benjamin Franklin, then Postmaster General of Pennsylvania. That sagacious personage, the sublime of common sense, about equal in his instincts and motives of character to the respectable average of the New England that produced him, but gifted with a versatile power of brain rarely matched on earth, was then divided between his strong desire to repel a danger of which he saw the imminence, and his equally strong antagonism to the selfish claims of the Penns, proprietaries of Pennsylvania. This last motive had determined his attitude towards their representative, the governor, and led him into an opposition, as injurious to the military good name of the province, as it was favorable to its political longings. In the present case there was no such conflict of inclinations. He could help Braddock without hurting Pennsylvania. He and his son had visited the camp, and found the general waiting restlessly for the report of the agents whom he had sent to collect wagons. "I stayed with him," says Franklin, "several days, and dined with him daily. When I was about to depart, the returns of wagons to be obtained were brought in, by which it appeared that they amounted only to 25, and not all of these were in serviceable condition. In this the general and his officers declared that the expedition was at an end, and denounced the ministry for sending them into a country void of the means of transportation. Franklin remarked that it was a pity they had not landed in Pennsylvania, where almost every farmer had his wagon. Braddock caught eagerly at his words, and begged that he would use his influence to enable the troops to move. Franklin went back to Pennsylvania, issued an address to the farmers appealing to their interest and their fears, and in a fortnight procured 150 wagons, with a large number of horses. Braddock, grateful to his benefactor, and enraged at everybody else, pronounced him almost the only instance of ability and honesty I have known in these provinces. More wagons and more horses gradually arrived, and at the 11th hour the march began. In the 10th of May Braddock reached Wills Creek, where the whole force was now gathered, having marched thither by detachments along the banks of the Potomac. This old trading station of the Ohio Company had been transformed into a military post and named Fort Cumberland. During the past winter the independent companies which had failed Washington in his need had been at work here to prepare a base of operations for Braddock. Their axes had been of more avail than their muskets. A broad wound had been cut in the bosom of the forest, and the murdered oaks and chestnuts turned into ramparts, barracks, and magazines. Fort Cumberland was an enclosure of logs set upright in the ground, pierced with loopholes, and armed with 10 small cannon. It stood in a rising ground near the point where Wills Creek joined the Potomac, and the forest girded it like a mighty hedge, or rather like a paling of gaunt brown stems upholding a canopy of green. All around spread illimitable woods, wrapping hill, valley, and mountain. The spot was an oasis in a desert of leaves, if the name oasis can be given to anything so rude and harsh. In this rugged area, or clearing, all Braddock's force was now assembled, amounting, regulars, provincials, and sailors, to about 2,200 men. The two regiments, Hawkett's and Dunbar's, had been completed by enlistment in Virginia to 700 men each. Of Virginians there were 9 companies of 50 men, who found no favor in the eyes of Braddock or his officers. To Ensign Allen of Hawkett's regiment was assigned the duty of making them, as much like soldiers as possible, that is, of drilling them like regulars. The general had little hope of them, and informed Sir Thomas Robinson that their slothful and languid disposition renders them very unfit for military service, a point in which he lived to change his mind. 30 sailors, whom Commodore Cattell had lent him, were more to his liking, and were in fact of value in many ways. He had now about 600 baggage horses, besides those of the artillery, all weakening daily on their diet of leaves, for no grass was to be found. There was great show of discipline, and little real order. Braddock's executive capacity seems to have been moderate, and his dogged, imperious temper, rasped by disappointments, was in constant irritation. "He looks upon the country, I believe," writes Washington, "as void of honor or honesty. We have frequent disputes on this head, which are maintained with warmth in both sides, especially on his, as he is incapable of arguing without it, or giving up any point he asserts, be it ever so incompatible with reason or common sense. Braddock's secretary, the younger Shirley, writing to his friend Governor Morris, spoke thus irreverently of his chief, as the king said of a neighboring governor of yours left square bracket sharp right square bracket, when proposed for the command of the American forces about a 12-month ago, and recommended as a very honest man, though not remarkably able, a little more ability and a little less honesty upon the present occasion might serve our turn better point. It is a joke to suppose that secondary officers can make amends for the defects of the first. The mainspring must be the mover. As to the others, I don't think we have much to boast. Some are insolent and ignorant, others capable, but rather aiming at showing their own abilities than making a proper use of them. I have a very great love for my friend Orm, and think it uncommonly fortunate for our leader that he is under the influence of so honest and capable a man, but I wish for the sake of the public he had some more experience of business, particularly in America. I am greatly disgusted at seeing an expedition, as it is called, so ill-concerted originally in England, so improperly conducted, since in America. Quote, Captain Robert Orm, of whom Shirley speaks, was aide-de-camp to Braddock, and author of a copious and excellent journal of the expedition, now in the British Museum. His portrait, painted at full length by Sir Joshua Reynolds, hangs in the National Gallery at London. He stands by his horse, a gallant young figure, with a face pale, yet rather handsome, booted to the knee. His scarlet coat, ample waistcoat, and small three-cornered hat all heavy with gold lace. The general had two other aides-de-camp, Captain Roger Morris and Colonel George Washington, whom he had invited, in terms that do him honor, to become one of his military family. It has been said that Braddock despised not only provincials, but Indians. Nevertheless, he took some pains to secure their aid, and complained that Indian affairs had been so ill conducted by the provinces that it was hard to gain their confidence. This was true, the tribes had been alienated by gross neglect. Had they been protected from injustice and soothed by attentions and presents, the Five Nations, Delawares, and Shawnees would have been retained as friends. But their complaints had been slighted, and every gift begrudged. The trader Crown brought, however, about 50 warriors, with as many women and children, to the camp at Fort Cumberland. They were objects of great curiosity to the soldiers, who gazed with astonishment on their faces painted red, yellow, and black, their ears slipped and hung with pendants, and their heads close shaved, except the feathered scalp locket the crown. In the day, says an officer, they are in our camp, and in the night they go into their own, where they dance and make the most horrible noise. Braddock received them several times in his tent, ordered the guard to salute them, made them speeches, caused cannon to be fired and drums and fifes to play in their honor, regaled them with rum, and gave them a bullock for a feast, whereupon, being much pleased, they danced a war dance, described by one spectator as droll and odd, showing how they scalp and fight, after which, says another, they set up the most horrid song or cry that ever I heard. These warriors, with a few others, promised the general to join him on the march, but he apparently grew tired of them, for a famous chief, called Scaroidy, afterwards complained, he looked upon us as dogs, and would never hear anything that we said to him. Only 8 of them remained with him to the end. Another ally appeared at the camp. This was a personage long known in Western fireside story as Captain Jack, the Black Hunter, or the Black Rifle. It was said of him that, having been a settler in the farthest frontier, in the valley of the Juniata, he returned one evening to his cabin and found it burned to the ground by Indians, and the bodies of his wife and children lying among the ruins. He vowed undying vengeance, raised a band of kindred spirits, dressed and painted like Indians, and became the scourge of the red man and the champion of the white. But he and his wild crew, useful as they might have been, shocked Braddock's sense of military fitness, and he received them so coldly that they left him. It was the 10th of June, before the army was well on its march. 300 axemen led the way, to cut and clear the road, and the long train of pack horses, wagons, and cannon toiled in behind, over the stumps, roots, and stones of the narrow track, the regulars and provincials marching in the forest close on either side. Squads of men were thrown out on the flanks, and scouts ranged the woods to guard against surprise, for, with all his scorn of Indians and Canadians, Braddock did not neglect reasonable precautions. Thus, foot by foot, they advanced into the waste of lonely mountains that divided the streams flowing to the Atlantic from those flowing to the Gulf of Mexico, a realm of forests ancient as the world. The road was but 12 feet wide, and the line of march often extended 4 miles. It was like a thin, long parti-colored snake, red, blue, and brown, trailing slowly through the depth of leaves, creeping round inaccessible heights, crawling over ridges, moving always in dampness and shadow, by rivulets and waterfalls, crags and chasms, gorges and shaggy steps. In glimpses only, through jagged boughs and flickering leaves, did this wild primeval world reveal itself, with its dark green mountains, flecked with the morning mist, and its distant summits penciled in dreamy blue. The army passed the main Allegheny, Meadow Mountain, and Great Savage Mountain, and traversed the funereal pine forest afterwards called the Shades of Death. No attempt was made to interrupt their march, though the commandant of Fort Duquesne had sent out parties for that purpose. A few French and Indians hovered about them, now and then scalping a straggler or inscribing filthy insults on trees, while others fell upon the border settlements which the advance of the troops had left defenseless. Here they were more successful, butchering about 30 persons, chiefly women and children. It was the 18th of June, before the army reached a place called the Little Meadows, less than 30 miles from Fort Cumberland. Fever and dysentery among the men, and the weakness and worthlessness of many of the horses, joined to the extreme difficulty of the road, so retarded them that they could move scarcely more than 3 miles a day. Braddock consulted with Washington, who advised him to leave the heavy baggage to follow, as it could, and push forward with a body of chosen troops. This counsel was given in view of a report that 500 regulars were on the way to reinforce Fort Duquesne. It was adopted. Colonel Dunbar was left to command the rear division, whose powers of movement were now reduced to the lowest point. The advance corps, consisting of about 1,200 soldiers, besides officers and drivers, began its march in the 19th with such artillery as was thought indispensable, 30 wagons, and a large number of pack horses. The prospect, writes Washington to his brother, conveyed infinite delight to my mind, though I was excessively ill at the time. But this prospect was soon clouded, and my hopes brought very low indeed, when I found that, instead of pushing on with vigor without regarding a little rough road, they were halting to level every molehill, and to erect bridges over every brook, by which means we were 4 days in getting 12 miles. It was not till the 7th of July that they neared the mouth of Turtle Creek, a stream entering the Monongahela about 8 miles from the French fort. The way was direct and short, but would lead them through a difficult country and a defile so perilous that Braddock resolved to ford the Monongahela to avoid this danger, and then ford it again to reach his destination. Fort Duquesne stood in the point of land where the Allegheny and the Monongahela joined to form the Ohio, and where now stands Pittsburgh, with its swarming population, its restless industries, the clang of its forges, and its chimneys vomiting foul smoke into the face of heaven. At that early day a white flag fluttering over a cluster of palisades and embankments betokened the first intrusion of civilized men upon a scene which, a few months before, breathed the repose of a virgin wilderness, voiceless but for the lapping of waves upon the pebbles, or the note of some lonely bird. But now the sleep of ages was broken, and bugle and drum told the astonished forest that its doom was pronounced and its days numbered. The fort was a compact little work, solidly built and strong, compared with others in the continent. It was a square of 4 bastions, with the water close on 2 sides, and the other 2 protected by ravelins, ditch, glacis, and covered way. The ramparts in these sides were of squared logs, filled in with earth, and 10 feet or more thick. The 2 water sides were enclosed by a massive stockade of upright logs, 12 feet high, mortised together and loopholed. The armament consisted of a number of small cannon mounted in the bastions. A gate and drawbridge in the east side gave access to the area within, which was surrounded by barracks for the soldiers, officers' quarters, the lodgings of the commandant, a guardhouse, and a storehouse, all built partly of logs and partly of boards. There were no casemates, and the place was commanded by a high woody hill beyond the Monongahela. The forest had been cleared away to the distance of more than a musket shot from the ramparts, and the stumps were hacked level with the ground. Here, just outside the ditch, bark cabins had been built for such of the troops and Canadians as could not find room within, and the rest of the open space was covered with Indian corn and other crops. The garrison consisted of a few companies of the regular troops stationed permanently in the colony, and to these were added a considerable number of Canadians. Contrecoeur still held the command. Under him were 3 other captains, Ogieu, Dumas, and Ligneris. Besides the troops and Canadians, 800 Indian warriors, mustered from far and near, had built their wigwams and camp sheds in the open ground, or under the edge of the neighboring woods, very little to the advantage of the young corn. Some were baptized savages settled in Canada, Chronologus from Sault Street, Louis, Abenakis from St. Francis, and Hurons from Lorette, whose chief bore the name of Anastase, in honor of that father of the church. The rest were unmitigated heathen, Potawatomis and Ojibways from the northern lakes under Charles Langlade, the same bold partisan who had led them, 3 years before, to attack the Miamis at Picobillany. Chanos and Mingos from the Ohio, and Ottawas from Detroit, commanded, it is said, by that most redoubtable of savages, Pontiac. The law of the survival of the fittest had wrought on this heterogeneous crew through countless generations, and with the primitive Indian, the fittest was the hardiest, fiercest, most adroit, and most wily. Baptized and heathen alike, they had just enjoyed a diversion greatly to their taste. A young Pennsylvanian named James Smith, a spirited and intelligent boy of 18, had been waylaid by 3 Indians in the western borders of the province and led captive to the fort. When the party came to the edge of the clearing, his captors, who had shot and scalped his companion, raised the scalp yell, whereupon a din of responsive whoops and firing of guns rose from all the Indian camps, and their inmates swarmed out like bees, while the French in the forts shot off muskets and cannon to honor the occasion. The unfortunate boy, the object of this obstreperous rejoicing, presently saw a multitude of savages, naked, hideously bedaubed with red, blue, black, and brown, and armed with sticks or clubs, ranging themselves in two long parallel lines, between which he was told that he must run, the faster the better, as they would beat him all the way. He ran with his best speed, under a shower of blows, and had nearly reached the end of the course, when he was knocked down. He tried to rise, but was blinded by a handful of sand thrown into his face, and then they beat him till he swooned. In coming to his senses he found himself in the fort, with the surgeon opening a vein in his arm and a crowd of French and Indians looking on. In a few days he was able to walk with the help of a stick, and, coming out from his quarters one morning, he saw a memorable scene. 3 days before, an Indian had brought the report that the English were approaching, and the Chevalier de La Pirade was sent out to reconnoiter. He returned in the next day, the 7th, with news that they were not far distant. In the 8th the brothers Normanville went out, and found that they were within 6 leagues of the fort. The French were in great excitement and alarm, but Contrecoeur at length took a resolution, which seems to have been inspired by Beaujeu. It was determined to meet the enemy in the march, and ambuscade them, if possible at the crossing of the Monongahela, or some other favorable spot. Beaujeu proposed a plan to the Indians, and offered them the war hatchet, but they would not take it. "Do you want to die, my father, and sacrifice us besides?" That night they held a council, and in the morning again refused to go. Beaujeu did not despair. "I am determined," he exclaimed, "to meet the English." "What? Will you let your father go alone?" The greater part caught fire at his words, promised to follow him and put on their war paint. Beaujeu received the communion, then dressed himself like a savage, and joined the clamorous throng. Open barrels of gunpowder and bullets were set before the gate of the fort, and James Smith, painfully climbing the rampart with the help of his stick, looked down on the warrior rabble, as, huddling together, wild with excitement, they scooped up the contents to fill their powder horns and pouches. Then, bend after bend, they filed off along the forest track that led to the fort of the Monongahela. They numbered 637, and with them went 36 French officers and cadets, 72 regular soldiers, and 146 Canadians, or about 900 in all. At 8 o'clock the tumult was over. The broad clearing lay lonely and still, and Contrecoeur, with what was left of his garrison, waited in suspense for the issue. It was near 1 o'clock, when Braddock crossed the Monongahela for the second time. If the French made a stand anywhere, it would be, he thought, at the fording place, but Lieutenant Colonel Gage, whom he sent across with a strong advance party, found no enemy, and quietly took possession of the farther shore. Then the main body followed. To impose on the imagination of the French scouts, who were doubtless on the watch, the movement was made with studied regularity and order. The sun was cloudless, and the men were inspirited by the prospect of near triumph. Washington afterwards spoke with admiration of the spectacle. The music, the banners, the mounted officers, the troop of light cavalry, the naval detachment, the red-coated regulars, the blue-coated Virginians, the wagons and tumbrils, cannon, howitzers, and coehorns, the train of pack horses, and the droves of cattle, passed in long procession through the rippling shallows, and slowly entered the bordering forest. Here, when all were over, a short halt was ordered for rest and refreshment. Why had not Oju defended the ford? This was his intention in the morning, but he had been met by obstacles, the nature of which is not wholly clear. His Indians, it seems, had proved refractory. 300 of them left him, went off in another direction, and did not rejoin him till the English had crossed the river. Hence perhaps it was that, having left Fort Duquesne at 8 o'clock, he spent half the day in marching 7 miles, and was more than a mile from the fording place, when the British reached the eastern shore. The delay, from whatever cause arising, cost him the opportunity of laying an ambush either at the fort or in the gullies and ravines that channeled the forest through which Braddock was now on the point of marching. Not far from the bank of the river, and close by the British line of march, there was a clearing and a deserted house that had once belonged to the trader Fraser. Washington remembered it well. It was here that he found rest and shelter in the winter journey homeward from his mission to Fort Leboeuf. He was in no less need of rest at this moment, for recent fever had so weakened him that he could hardly sit his horse. From Fraser's house to Fort Duquesne the distance was 8 miles by a rough path, along which the troops were now beginning to move after their halt. It ran inland for a little, then curved to the left, and followed a course parallel to the river along the base of a line of steep hills that here bordered the valley. These and all the country were buried in dense and heavy forest, choked with bushes and the carcasses of fallen trees. Braddock has been charged with marching blindly into an ambuscade, but it was not so. There was no ambuscade, and had there been one, he would have found it. It is true that he did not reconnoiter the woods very far in advance of the head of the column, yet, with this exception, he made elaborate dispositions to prevent surprise. Several knights, with 6 Virginian light horsemen, led the way. Then, a musket shot behind, came the vanguard, then 300 soldiers under Gage, then a large body of axemen, under Sir John Sinclair, to open the road, then to cannon with tumbrils and tool wagons, and lastly the rear guard, closing the line, while flanking parties ranged the woods in both sides. This was the advance column. The main body followed with little or no interval. The artillery and wagons moved along the road, and the troops filed through the woods close on either hand. Numerous flanking parties were thrown out 100 yards and more to right and left, while, in the space between them and the marching column, the pack horses and cattle, with their drivers, made their way painfully among the trees and thickets, since, had they been allowed to follow the road, the line of march would have been too long for mutual support. A body of regulars and provincials brought up the rear. Gage, with his advance column, had just passed a wide and bushy ravine that crossed their path, and the van of the main column was on the point of entering it, when the guides and light horsemen in the front suddenly fell back, and the engineer, Gordon, then engaged in marking out the road, saw a man, dressed like an Indian, but wearing the gorget of an officer, bounding forward along the path. He stopped, when he discovered the head of the column, turned, and waved his hat. The forest behind was swarming with French and savages. At the signal of the officer, who was probably Beaujeu, they yelled the war whoop, spread themselves to right and left, and opened a sharp fire under cover of the trees. Gage's column wheeled deliberately into line, and fired several volleys with great steadiness against the now invisible assailants. Few of them were hurt, the trees caught the shot, but the noise was deafening under the dense arches of the forest. The greater part of the Canadians, to borrow the words of Dumas, fled shamefully, crying "Sauve qui peut!" Volley followed volley, and at the third Beaujeu dropped dead. Gauges to cannon were now brought to bear, in which the Indians, like the Canadians, gave way in confusion, but did not, like them, abandon the field. The close scarlet ranks of the English were plainly to be seen through the trees and the smoke. They were moving forward, cheering lustily, and shouting "God save the King!" Dumas, now chief in command, thought that all was lost. "I advanced," he says, "with the assurance that comes from despair, exciting by voice and gesture the few soldiers that remained. The fire of my platoon was so sharp that the enemy seemed astonished. The Indians, encouraged, began to rally. The French officers who commanded them showed admirable courage and address, and while Dumas and Ligneris, with the regulars and what was left of the Canadians, held the ground in front, the savage warriors, screeching their war cries, swarmed through the forest along both flanks of the English, hid behind trees, bushes, and fallen trunks, or crouched in gullies and ravines, and opened a deadly fire in the helpless soldiery, who, themselves completely visible, could see no enemy, and wasted volley after volley in the impassive trees. The most destructive fire came from a hill in the English right, where the Indians lay in multitudes, firing from their lurking places in the living target below. But the invisible death was everywhere, in front, flank, and rear. The British cheer was heard no more. The troops broke their ranks and huddled together in a bewildered mass, shrinking from the bullets that cut them down by scores. When Braddock heard the firing in the front, he pushed forward with the main body to the support of Gage, leaving 400 men in the rear, under Sir Peter Dockett, to guard the baggage. At the moment of his arrival, Gage's soldiers had abandoned their two cannon, and were falling back to escape the concentrated fire of the Indians. Meeting the advancing troops, they tried to find cover behind them. This threw the whole into confusion. The men of the two regiments became mixed together, and in a short time the entire force, except the Virginians and the troops left wing Dockett, were massed in several dense bodies within a small space of ground, facing some one way and some another, and all alike exposed without shelter to the bullets that pelted them like hail. Both men and officers were new to this blind and frightful warfare of the savage in his native woods. To charge the Indians in their hiding places would have been useless. They would have eluded pursuit with the agility of wildcats, and swarmed back, like angry hornets, the moment that it ceased. The Virginians alone were equal to the emergency. Fighting behind trees like the Indians themselves, they might have held the enemy in check till order could be restored, had not Braddock, furious at a proceeding that shocked all his ideas of courage and discipline, ordered them, with oaths, to form into line. A body of them under Captain Wagoner made a dash for a fallen tree lying in the woods, far out towards the lurking places of the Indians, and, crouching behind the huge trunk, opened fire. But the regulars, seeing the smoke among the bushes, mistook their best friends for the enemy, shot at them from behind, killed many, and forced the rest to return. A few of the regulars also tried in their clumsy way to fight behind trees, but Braddock beat them with his sword, and compelled them to stand with the rest, an open mark for the Indians. The panic increased, the soldiers crowded together, and the bullets spent themselves in a mass of human bodies. Commands, entreaties, and threats were lost upon them. "We would fight," some of them answered, "if we could see anybody to fight with." Nothing was visible but puffs of smoke. Officers and men who had stood all the afternoon under fire afterwards declared that they could not be sure they had seen a single Indian. Braddock ordered Lieutenant Colonel Bergman to attack the hill where the puffs of smoke were thickest, and the bullets most deadly. With infinite difficulty, that brave officer induced 100 men to follow him, but he was soon disabled by a wound, and they all faced about. The artillerymen stood for some time by their guns, which did great damage to the trees and little to the enemy. The mob of soldiers, stupefied with terror, stood panting, their foreheads beaded with sweat, loading and firing mechanically, sometimes into the air, sometimes among their own comrades, many of whom they killed. The ground, strewn with dead and wounded men, the bounding of maddened horses, the clatter and roar of musketry and cannon, mixed with the spiteful report of rifles and the yells that rose from the indefatigable throats of 600 unseen savages, formed a chaos of anguish and terror scarcely paralleled even in Indian war. I cannot describe the horrors of that scene, one of Braddock's officers wrote 3 weeks after. No pen could do it. The yell of the Indians is fresh on my ear, and the terrific sound will haunt me till the hour of my dissolution. Quote, Braddock showed a furious intrepidity. Mounted in horseback, he dashed to and fro, storming like a madman. 4 horses were shot under him, and he mounted a 5th. Washington seconded his chief with equal courage, he too no doubt using strong language, for he did not measure words when the fit was on him. He escaped, as by miracle. 2 horses were killed under him, and 4 bullets tore his clothes. The conduct of the British officers was above praise. Nothing could surpass their undaunted self-devotion, and in their vain attempts to lead in the men, the havoc among them was frightful. Sir Peter Tockett was shot dead. His son, a lieutenant in his regiment, stooping to raise the body of his father, was shot dead in turn. Young Shirley, Braddock's secretary, was pierced through the brain. Ormond Morris, his aides-de-camp, Sinclair, the quartermaster general, Gates and Gage, both afterwards conspicuous in opposite sides in the War of the Revolution, and Gladwin, who, 8 years later, defended Detroit against Pontiac, were all wounded. Of 86 officers, 63 were killed or disabled, while out of 1,373 non-commissioned officers and privates, only 459 came off unharmed. Braddock saw that all was lost. To save the wreck of his force from annihilation, he at last commanded a retreat, and as he and such of his officers as were left strove to withdraw the half-frenzied crew in some semblance of order, a bullet struck him down. The gallant bulldog fell from his horse, shot through the arm into the lungs. It is said, though on evidence of no weight, that the bullet came from one of his own men. Be this as it may, there he lay among the bushes, bleeding, gasping, unable even to curse. He demanded to be left where he was. Captain Stewart and another provincial bore him between them to the rear. It was about this time that the mob of soldiers, having been 3 hours under fire, and having spent their ammunition, broke away in a blind frenzy, rushed back towards the ford, and when, says Washington, we endeavored to rally them, it was with as much success as if we had attempted to stop the wild bears of the mountains. They dashed across, helter-skelter, plunging through the water to the farther bank, leaving wounded comrades, cannon, baggage, the military chest, and the general's papers, a prey to the Indians. About 50 of these followed to the edge of the river. Dumont Lignerus, who had now only about 20 Frenchmen with him, made no attempt to pursue, and went back to the fort, because, says Contrecoeur, so many of the Canadians had retired at the first fire. The field, abandoned to the savages, was a pandemonium of pillage and murder. In the defeat of Braddock, besides authorities already cited, Shirley to Robinson, the 5th of November, 1755, accompanying the plans of the battle reproduced in this volume, Public Record Office, America and West Indies, Uxxxl. The plans were drawn at Shirley's request by Patrick McAleer, chief engineer of the expedition, who was with Gage in the advance column, when the fight began. They were examined and fully approved by the chief surviving officers, and they closely correspond with another plan made by the aide-de-camp, which, however, shows only the beginning of the affair. Report of the Court of Inquiry into the behavior of the troops at the Monongahela. Letters of Dinwiddie. Letters of Gage. Bird to Morris, the 25th of July, 1755. Sinclair to Robinson, the 3rd of September. Rutherford to, the 12th of July. Writings of Washington, 2nd. 68 to 93, Review of Military Operations in North America. Endic, I. 145, Gentleman's Magazine, 1755, 378, 426. Letter to a Friend in the Ohio Defeat, Boston, 1755. Contrecoeur of Doddrill, 14 July, 1755. Estet de l'Artillerie, etc. Qui se centrave sur le champ de bataille. Doddrill au ministre, 5 Aout, 1755. Bigot au ministre, 27 Aout. Relation du combat du 9 juillet. Relation depuis le départ de troupes de Québec jusqu'au 30 mois de septembre. La Pinière d'Argenson, the 24th of October. Relation officielle imprimé au Louvre. Relation de Godefroy, chez. Extraits du registre du Fort Duquesne, Ibid. Relation de diverses mouvements, Ibid. Budget, I. 37 right square bracket. James Smith, the young prisoner at Fort Duquesne, had passed a day of suspense, waiting the result. In the afternoon I again observed a great noise and commotion in the fort, and, though at that time I could not understand French, I found it was the voice of joy and triumph, and feared that they had received what I called bad news. I had observed some of the old country soldiers speak Dutch. As I spoke Dutch, I went to one of them and asked him what was the news. He told me that a runner had just arrived who said that Braddock would certainly be defeated, that the Indians and French had surrounded him, and were concealed behind trees and in gullies, and kept a constant fire upon the English, and that they saw the English falling in heaps, and if they did not take the river, which was the only gap, and make their escape, there would not be one man left alive before sundown. Some time after this, I heard a number of scalp halloos, and saw a company of Indians and French coming in. I observed they had a great number of bloody scalps, grenadiers' caps, British canteens, bayonets, etc. with them. They brought the news that Braddock was defeated. After that another company came in, which appeared to be about 100, and chiefly Indians, and it seemed to me that almost every one of this company was carrying scalps. After this came another company with a number of wagon horses, and also a great many scalps. Those that were coming in and those that had arrived kept a constant firing of small arms, and also the great guns in the fort, which were accompanied with the most hideous shouts and yells from all quarters, so that it appeared to me as though the infernal regions had broke loose. Quote, about sundown I beheld a small party coming in with about a dozen prisoners, stripped naked, with their hands tied behind their backs and their faces and part of their bodies blacked. These prisoners they burned to death in the bank of Allegheny River, opposite the fort. I stood in the fort wall, until I beheld them begin to burn one of these men. They had him tied to a stake, and kept touching him with firebrands, red-hot irons, etc. And he screaming in a most doleful manner, the Indians in the meantime yelling like infernal spirits. As the scene appeared too shocking for me to behold, I retired to my lodging, both sore and sorry. When I came into my lodgings I saw Russell's 7 sermons, which they had brought from the field of battle, which his Frenchmen made a present of to me. Quote, the loss of the French was slight, but fell chiefly on the officers, 3 of whom were killed, and 4 wounded. Of the regular soldiers, all but 4 escaped untouched. The Canadians suffered still less in proportion to their numbers, only 5 of them being hurt. The Indians, who won the victory, or the principal loss. Of those from Canada, 27 were killed and wounded, while the casualties among the western tribes are not reported. All of these last went off the next morning with their plunder and scalps, leaving Contrecœur in great anxiety, lest the remnant of Braddock's troops, reinforced by the division under Dunbar, should attack him again. His doubts would have vanished had he known the condition of his defeated enemy. In the pain and languor of a mortal wound, Braddock showed unflinching resolution. His bearer stopped with him at a favorable spot beyond the Monongahela, and here he hoped to maintain his position till the arrival of Dunbar. By the efforts of the officers about 100 men were collected around him, but to keep them there was impossible. Within an hour they abandoned him, and fled like the rest. Gage, however, succeeded in rallying about 80 beyond the other fording place, and Washington, in an order from Braddock, spurred his jaded horse towards the camp of Dunbar to demand wagons, provisions, and hospital stores. Fright overcame fatigue. The fugitives toiled in all night, pursued by specters of horror and despair, hearing still the war whoops and the shrieks, possessed with the one thought of escape from the wilderness of death. In the morning some order was restored. Braddock was placed on a horse, then, the pain being insufferable, he was carried in a litter, Captain Orme having bribed the carriers by the promise of a guinea and a bottle of rum apiece. Early in the succeeding night, such as had not fainted in the way reached the deserted farm of Gist. Here they met wagons and provisions, with a detachment of soldiers sent by Dunbar, whose camp was 6 miles farther on, and Braddock ordered them to go to the relief of the stragglers left behind. At noon of that day a number of wagoners and pack horse drivers had come to Dunbar's camp with wild tidings of rout and ruin. More fugitives followed, and soon after a wounded officer was brought in upon a sheet. The drums beat to arms. The camp was in commotion, and many soldiers and teamsters took to flight, in spite of the sentinels, who tried in vain to stop them. There was a still more disgraceful scene in the next day, after Braddock, with the wreck of his force, had arrived. Orders were given to destroy such of the wagons, stores, and ammunition, as could not be carried back at once to Fort Cumberland. Whether Dunbar or the dying general gave these orders is not clear, but it is certain that they were executed with shameful alacrity. More than 100 wagons were burned, cannon, coehorns, and shells were burst or buried, barrels of gunpowder were staved, and the contents thrown into a brook, Provisions were scattered through the woods and swamps. Then the whole command began its retreat over the mountains to Fort Cumberland, 60 miles distant. This proceeding, for which, in view of the condition of Braddock, Dunbar must be held answerable, excited the utmost indignation among the colonists. If he could not advance, they thought, he might at least have fortified himself and held his ground till the provinces could send him help, thus covering the frontier, and holding French war parties in check. Braddock's last moment was near. Orme, who, though himself severely wounded, was with him till his death, told Franklin that he was totally silent all the first day, and at night said only, who would have thought it, that all the next day he was again silent, till at last he muttered, we shall better know how to deal with them another time, and died a few minutes after. He had nevertheless found breath to give orders at gists for the succor of the men who had dropped on the road. It is said, too, that in his last hours he could not bear the sight of a red coat, but murmured praises of the Blues, or Virginians, and said that he hoped he should live to reward them. He died at about 8 o'clock in the evening of Sunday, the 13th. Dunbar had begun his retreat that morning, and was then encamped near the Great Meadows. In Monday the dead commander was buried in the road, and men, horses, and wagons passed over his grave, effacing every sign of it, lest the Indians should find and mutilate the body. Colonel James Innes, commanding at Fort Cumberland, where a crowd of invalids with soldiers' wives and other women had been left when the expedition marched, heard of the defeat, only 2 days after it happened, from a wagoner who had fled from the field in horseback. He at once sent a note of 6 lines to Lord Fairfax, I have this moment received the most melancholy news of the defeat of our troops, the general killed, and numbers of our officers, our whole artillery taken. In short, the account I have received is so very bad, that, as, please God, I intend to make a stand here, 'tis highly necessary to raise the militia everywhere to defend the frontiers. A boy whom he sent out on horseback met more fugitives, and came back on the 14th with reports as vague and disheartening as the first. Innes sent them to Dinwiddie. Some days after, Dunbar and his train arrived in miserable disorder, and Fort Cumberland was turned into a hospital for the shattered fragments of a routed and ruined army. In the 16th a letter was brought in haste to one Buchanan at Carlisle, in the Pennsylvanian frontier. Sir, I thought it proper to let you know that I was in the battle, where we were defeated. And we had about 1,150 private men, besides officers and others. And we were attacked the 9th day about 12 o'clock, and held till about 3 in the afternoon, and then we were forced to retreat, when I suppose we might bring off about 300 whole men, besides a vast many wounded. Most of our officers were either wounded or killed. General Braddock is wounded, but I hope not mortal, and Sir John Sinclair and many others, but I hope not mortal. All the train is cut off in a manner. Sir Peter Dockett and his son, Captain Paulson, Captain Jethan, Captain Rose, Captain Tatton killed, and many others. Captain Ord of the train is wounded, but I hope not mortal. We lost all our artillery entirely, and everything else. To Mr. John Smith and Buchanan, and give it to the next post, and let him show this to Mr. George Gibson in Lancaster, and Mr. Bingham, at the sign of the ship, and you'll oblige. Yours to command. John Campbell, Messenger. The evil tidings quickly reached Philadelphia, where such confidence had prevailed that certain overzealous persons had begun to collect money for fireworks to celebrate the victory. Two of these, brother physicians named Bond, came to Franklin and asked him to subscribe, but the sage looked doubtful. "Why, the devil," said one of them, "you surely don't suppose the fort will not be taken?" He reminded them that war is always uncertain, and the subscription was deferred. The governor laid the news of the disaster before his council, telling them at the same time that his opponents in the assembly would not believe it, and had insulted him in the street for giving it currency. Dinwiddie remained tranquil at Williamsburg, sure that all would go well. The brief note on Innes, forwarded by Lord Fairfax, first disturbed his dream of triumph, but on second thought he took comfort. "I am willing to think that account was from a deserter who, in a great panic, represented what his fears suggested. I wait with impatience for another express from Fort Cumberland, which I expect will greatly contradict the former." The news got abroad, and the slaves showed signs of excitement. "The villainy of the Negroes in any emergency is what I always feared," continues the governor. "An example of one or two at first may prevent these creatures entering into combinations and wicked designs." And he wrote to Lord Halifax, "The Negro slaves have been very audacious in the news of defeat in the Ohio. These poor creatures imagine the French will give them their freedom. We have too many here, but I hope we shall be able to keep them in proper subjection." Suspense grew intolerable. "It's monstrous they should be so tardy and dilatory in sending down any farther account." He sent Major Colin Campbell for news, when, a day or two later, a courier brought him two letters, one from Orme, and the other from Washington, both written at Fort Cumberland in the 18th. The letter of Orme began thus, "My dear Governor, I am so extremely ill in bed with the wound I have received that I am under the necessity of employing my friend Captain Dobson as my scribe." Then he told the wretched story of defeat and humiliation. The officers were absolutely sacrificed by their unparalleled good behavior, advancing before their men sometimes in bodies, and sometimes separately, hoping by such an example to engage the soldiers to follow them, but to no purpose. Poor Shirley was shot through the head, Captain Morris very much wounded. Mr. Washington had two horses shot under him, and his clothes shot through in several places, behaving the whole time with the greatest courage and resolution. Quote, Washington wrote more briefly, saying that, as Orme was giving a full account of the affair, it was needless for him to repeat it. Like many others in the fight, he greatly underrated the force of the enemy, which he placed at 300, or about a third of the actual number, a natural error, as most of the assailants were invisible. Our poor Virginians behaved like men, and died like soldiers, for I believe that out of three companies that were there that day, scarce 30 were left alive. Captain Pirani and all his officers down to a corporal were killed. Captain Paulson shared almost as hard a fate, for only one of his escaped. In short, the dastardly behavior of the English soldiers exposed all those who were inclined to do their duty to almost certain death. It is imagined, I believe with great justice, too, that two-thirds of both killed and wounded received their shots from our own cowardly dogs of soldiers, who gathered themselves into a body, contrary to orders, 10 and 12 deep, would then level, fire, and shoot down the men before them. Quote, to Orme, Dinwiddie replied, I read your letter with tears in my eyes, but it gave me much pleasure to see your name at the bottom, and more so, when I observed by the postscript that your wound is not dangerous. But pray, dear sir, is it not possible by a second attempt to retrieve the great loss we have sustained? I presume the general's chariot is at the fort, In it you may come here, and my house is heartily at your command. Pray take care of your valuable health, keep your spirits up, and I doubt not of your recovery. My wife and girls join me in most sincere respects and joy at your being so well, and I always am, with great truth, to your friend, your affectionate humble servant. Quote, to Washington he is less effusive, though he had known him much longer. He begins, it is true, to your Washington, and congratulates him on his escape, but soon grows formal, and asks, pray, sir, with a number of them remaining, is there no possibility of doing something on the other side of the mountains before the winter months? Surely you must mistake. Colonel Dunbar will not march to winter quarters in the middle of summer, and leave the frontiers exposed to the invasions of the enemy. No, he is a better officer, and I have a different opinion of him. I sincerely wish you health and happiness, and am, with great respect, sir, your obedient, humble servant. Quote, Washington's letter had contained the astonishing announcement that Dunbar meant to abandon the frontier and march to Philadelphia. Dinwiddie, much disturbed, at once wrote to that officer, though without betraying any knowledge of his intention. Sir, the melancholy account of the defeat of our forces gave me a sensible and real concern, in which he enlarges for a while, then suddenly changes style. Dear Colonel, is there no method left to retrieve the dishonor done to the British arms? As you now command all the forces that remain, are you not able, after a proper refreshment of your men, to make a second attempt? You have 4 months now to come of the best weather of the year for such an expedition. What a fine field for honor will Colonel Dunbar have to confirm and establish his character as a brave officer. Then, after suggesting plans of operation, and entering into much detail, the fervid governor concludes, it gives me great pleasure that under our great loss and misfortunes the command devolves on an officer of so great military judgment and established character. With my sincere respect and hearty wishes for success to all your proceedings, I am, worthy sir, your most obedient, humble servant. Quote, exhortation and flattery were lost on Dunbar. Dinwiddie received from him in reply a short, dry note, dated in the 1st of August, and acquainting him that he should march for Philadelphia on the 2nd. This, in fact, he did, leaving the fort to be defended by invalids and a few Virginians. I acknowledge, says Dinwiddie, I was not brought up to arms, but I think common sense would have prevailed not to leave the frontiers exposed after having opened a road over the mountains to the Ohio, by which the enemy can the more easily invade us. Your great colonel, he writes to Orme, is gone to a peaceful colony, and left our frontiers open. The whole conduct of Colonel Dunbar appears to me monstrous. To march off all the regulars, and leave the fort and frontiers to be defended by 400 sick and wounded, and the poor remains of our provincial forces, appears to me absurd. Quote, he found some comfort from the Burgesses, who gave him £40,000, and would, he thinks, have given £100,000, if another attempt against Fort Duquesne had been set afoot. Shirley, too, whom the death of Braddock had made commander-in-chief, approved the governor's plan of renewing offensive operations, and instructed Dunbar to that effect, ordering him, however, should they prove impracticable, to march for Albany in aid of the Niagara expedition. The order found him safe in Philadelphia. Here he lingered for a while, then marched to join the Northern Army, moving at a pace which made it certain that he could not arrive in time to be of the least use. Thus the frontier was left unguarded, and soon, as Dinwiddie had foreseen, There burst upon it a storm of blood and fire.